Body with Pat McDonald.
Hello and welcome to episode 41 of Over My Dad Body. I, as always, am your host, comedian Pat McDonald. Talking to dads, and there's been one mom, love to get more moms on the show, but talking to parents of children, talking about experiences in parenting is what I was trying to say. Things you've learned, things you wish you knew going in. So I talk to, if you're a new listener, a wide array of different people. Today's guest is DJ Trackstar, a member of my absolute favorite hip-hop group, Run the Jewels. I think they are the best doing it right now, and willing to debate, but you are not going to win that argument. So it was really cool to get to talk to him. Get to that in a moment. Little segue. We talked about cats. His cat's name is Wolfie, and it is named Wolfie for the reason that I had hoped. And so my respect and appreciation for him went up a notch after learning the source of that name. We have a new cat. I don't know if I've mentioned that. His name is Peaches. And didn't that adorable little motherfucker bring Ringworm into our home? So now it's a situation where he and our other cat, Muggins, have to quarantine in my office for 6 weeks. So we do not live in a big house. It just got smaller. So that's really, really annoying. Hope you guys are staying safe, not getting Ringworm, not getting COVID. It's crazy to me with all the people who are anti-mask, usually being led by someone who has a decent amount of money. And so I liken that, like if you look at Rudy Giuliani, he got COVID, he immediately gets the best healthcare treatment available because he's in a position of power and he has money. I liken that to if you knew a guy who was very rich and well insured, and you were a poor person, and he wanted to race cars. He has a nice car, and you don't have a nice car. Your car's kind of crummy. He wants to race, and he convinces you to do it. Well, if you guys both crash, he's got insurance. He's fine. You, on the other hand, you're shit out of luck. So if you look at it that way, that's kind of the comparison I've made. The point I'm trying to make, please wear a mask. Don't listen to idiots. Listen to scientists. So many people are dumb. Hopefully you're not one. But if you are, just don't be dumb with this one thing. Please wear a mask. Talking to DJ Trackstar, it was cool. The story of how he started working with Killer Mike and eventually Run the Jewels is a very interesting one. I'd read about it, and he confirmed and told the story in detail, and it's really interesting and cool. They put out their latest album in the summer, RTJ4. It is just fantastic. I love it. I listened to it nonstop for like 6 months. I encourage you, if you're not familiar with their music, check them out. They are incredible. Hoping to check them out in concert when concerts are a thing again. So we're going to jump into things. Please rate and subscribe to the podcast. It helps out immensely. Have a number of really cool, interesting guests lined up, as well as some I've already spoken with. So those episodes will be coming out soon. So please enjoy episode 41 with DJ Trackstar. Hey, how's it going?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Doing well. Appreciate you taking the time to do the show. You mentioned you're currently in St. Louis. How are things there? And I know that's a very broad question, by the way, because there's a lot going on in your country.
Yeah. I kind of always answer the same way, which is inside the house, things are pretty great. Once you take a step outside, it gets a little shaky, you know, with the pandemic. And, you know, the city, like a lot of places, there's plenty of people that do wear masks, but there's also plenty of people that don't. So, you know, we just don't leave the house much. So I don't really know much of what's going on.
Yeah.
Unless it's between here and the park, then, you know, I know those three blocks really well. Past that, I don't really know what's going on around here.
It's man, it has been similar for me for sure. I've been at home since the NBA decided that it was not safe. And yeah, it's incredible. I look at the step counter on my phone without leaving the house, and I'm doing 10,000 a day. And I recently discovered a beer delivery service. So I have not left the house for anything. It's except for what you said, going to the park. But you're not originally from St. Louis, are you?
No, I grew up in Wisconsin. Kind of the closest thing to being Canada without being Canada, so to speak. And then I came to St. Louis for college. So when I was 18. And then I was here for 10 years, and then I left for 10 years and bounced around, and then we just moved back in February.
Okay, nice. And what was life like growing up in Wisconsin? Like, what did your parents do? Did you have any siblings? What was that dynamic like?
Yeah, I've got two younger brothers and an older sister. My mom was a stay-at-home mom for a while, and then once we all got old enough, she would kind of work at the schools that we went to. She kind of followed us. And then my dad worked for the state for a while, and then started his own consulting business for a while. So I mean, I had a pretty, great childhood. Lived in a nice neighborhood. Nice middle class, comfortable neighborhood, parks, and it was pretty. Yeah, I mean, I think it was a great upbringing in Madison, Wisconsin.
Nice, that's great. And so, do you still get along with all your siblings? Is everything good there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We've got group texts and stuff, and yeah, I talk to all of them pretty regularly.
Okay, yeah, I mean that's always good. I mean, I found that stuff like that, if a family becomes fractured, that can kind of affect parenthood down the road for sure. As well as the support system. And so I know who you are because you are the DJ for what I consider to be the best rap group on planet Earth, Run the Jewels.
Appreciate that, man. Thank you.
I mean it. You don't know me very well at all, but I'm not one to throw out compliments for no good reason. And so are any of your other siblings involved at all in music?
Yeah, my middle brother is a drummer, and he plays in a band in Madison. And my younger brother and my sister—they both love music, but they don't directly participate.
Okay,
We all
cool.
took piano lessons when we were forced to take piano lessons as kids, so that we at least all have a little bit of background.
No, that's something I'm thinking of getting my son into when, it's age appropriate. He has this
Yeah,
little,
absolutely.
like the piano Tom Hanks plays in the movie Big. He has one of those that he stomps on like a maniac. And so how, you mentioned piano lessons. At what point did that kind of evolve into, a
Well,
passion?
it definitely didn't have it. I don't think one had to do with the other. And also, as a side note, I love the movie Big, and I hadn't thought about it before, but as of you mentioning that, I'm definitely going to get one of those pianos for Amina. Probably as soon as this interview finishes. That sounds great.
Nice. Yeah, I'm not musically inclined at all. But I've learned how to play ODB. I Like a Raw.
Nice.
So that's a fun one. My son will dance, so that's kind of fun. But yeah, when did things kind of, you mentioned, the piano lessons not necessarily tied to your pursuit and what now is your career, but how did that interest in producing music and DJing come about and evolve?
Well, yeah, so I mean, I did the piano because I had to. I'm pretty sure I wanted to quit, after like 2 years, but I played for like 7 or 8, but I didn't really apply myself. So, I never really got good or, didn't retain a lot of it. But then, when I fell in love with hip hop music in, seventh, eighth, ninth grade, that's when I really got musically focused, just as a fan. And I still wasn't really necessarily trying to participate so much as listen, for a lot of those first few years. I mean, I played around a little bit just for fun to see what it was like, but I wasn't anticipating anything. And then when I got to college, I got to the first building that I went to when I got there was the radio station. Shouts out to Derek Tesley. He was the hip hop director at the time, and we'd randomly ended up on the same hip hop email list. So I went there and he met me there, and I walked in and there was just like a wall of records of just hip hop. I mean, there was a whole room of records, but there was a wall of just hip hop records. It was just like every record I'd ever wanted to hear, but didn't have access to, it was just incredible. So in order to have access to it, I started a radio show so I'd be part of the station so that I could just go there anytime I want and listen to those records. So that's literally why I started DJing, was to listen to more records.
Nice.
And then just doing the radio show, just kind of led from there to doing, little events on campus and then, eventually stuff off campus and just get involved in the local St. Louis hip hop scene.
What is the, because I, I'm obviously a hip hop fan, but I don't have like a super deep knowledge of it like I would things like baseball or comedy. What was and is the St. Louis hip hop scene like?
On a national level, people generally just know Nelly and Shingy and Jake Kwan, which we had a little moment there, 2002 to 2004 or 2005. The scene I was participating in was the underground scene. That, there's a scene like this in every city where it's the people who are, playing the underground hip hop and b-boys and open mics and it's just this amazing scene full of all these incredibly talented people. And immediately once I got involved in it, like my main thing was just like, these guys are all so dope at what they do. Why don't more people know about them? And that's kind of like that always kind of turned into my mission as the DJ period is, there's this thing that I'm aware of that is incredible and I want to share it with people because, the people doing the amazing art should be heard and, I'm doing you a favor by giving you some amazing art to listen to. So, that just kind of spawned everything, mostly everything I've done since. It's still a big part of it is wanting to expose the amazing talent in St. Louis to the world. I just starting last night, actually James Biko, who's formerly known as DJ Needles, who was one of the DJs I was looking up to, when I first started DJing. I just added him as a resident guest mixer on my Shade 45 show. So that's, kind of keeping in line with that. I was really excited to bring, another St. Louis person onto the Shade airwaves.
Nice. How long have you been doing the radio show on Sirius XM?
It's 3 years now.
Oh, okay. Nice. And you mentioned,
just starting the fourth.
Cool. And so you mentioned, all the records that you saw when you were in college that, as you mentioned, were around the same age. The internet was not really, not even close to what it is today where you can literally get anything. Yeah. And so what were some of your influences at that point?
So before then, in Madison, I was just, so there's a hip hop scene in Madison too. I just kind of didn't know about it. I was in my little bubble. I was still playing sports, like high school, my whole like focus kind of shifted from sports to music, like just gradually over those 4 years. So I was still, just doing all my regular stuff. I just didn't get into the local hip hop scene in Madison. I just didn't really realize what was going on, which is too bad. I was too young to get into a lot of places, but I'm sure there was all of these events that I could have found, artists that I could have tried to meet and learn from. But so at that point, my relationship was just with the used CD store and, the very young, very simple hip hop internet, online rap world as it existed, in the late 90s. So it was a lot of like looking up stuff and getting recommendations from people that I met online, reading magazines and stuff, and then just going to the used CD store. And, as soon as I got into it, I was really interested in understanding the scope of it. So I would take lists of like the best albums of all time and like literally check them off and like go to the store and, see what I could find that I'd heard of. And just learn about it all. And at the time in Madison, Wisconsin, I thought I was like, the only person doing this or some shit.
Yeah.
not realizing that there was literally probably thousands of people
yeah.
listening to the same, you know, but it felt like this underground music that, you know, cause I didn't see it on TV or whatever. I thought, oh, I was the only person that knew about a lot of, you know, where I was at.
No, it's funny you mentioned that where, you know, you thought you were the only person. It just, it speaks to, and it's something I can definitely relate to with stand-up is, you know, when you're very new, you're naive, you don't know the lay of the land, you don't know, you know, the dynamic between, you know, the hierarchy of people who've been there and done that and your fresh meat. I remember I was very new. I started stand-up in 2008, and I had to fight tooth and nail. There's a chain of comedy clubs in Canada called Yuck Yucks. Mm-hmm. So I think there are 13 or 14 of them. And the big one is in Toronto. And I finally got on amateur night on a Tuesday. And there were like 200 people there. And I did my first 5 minutes and absolutely destroyed. Like better than I ever thought I could have done. I was like 2 months into it. And driving home, in my head, I was like, can't wait for that comedy phone call tomorrow where they set me on tour where I have 5 minutes. And now I look back and I'm like, that was terrible comedy. And that was just a dumb audience. You don't know what the fuck you're doing. And so when you're producing a track or, you know, whatever it may be, what is that process like? Because I know for me as a comic, like, I know there needs to be a setup, a punchline, and tags. But when I know nothing about music production, so how does your process specifically look when you're putting a song together?
So I play around with production, but I don't really produce, like, I play around with it a lot. I don't really play it for people most of the time.
Okay.
I haven't really put anything out. So that I just kind of do for fun. But you know, as far as like putting together the radio show or whatever, you know, it's just about collecting tracks and listening for, you know, what I like, because, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I can't, if I'm playing stuff that I'm personally don't enjoy, it that's going to come through. So, you know, just for the sake of everything, I don't do that. You know, no matter if I think it's like, oh, people will like this, or, you know, it would help be, you know, for promotion or whatever to play the, you know, so it's going through and listening to it, you know, what sounds good to me and what fits the show or the mixtape or, you know, the event, whatever I'm working on. And then just, you know, just piecing it together like a puzzle, just figuring out a beginning and an end, and then, you know, arc through the middle, you know, just of how you want it to run sound wise or energy wise, or, you know, depending on the application.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you, as I mentioned earlier, for those who aren't aware, you are the DJ for Run the Jewels. You're the only DJ that they've ever had. I read something about how that came to be. But if you don't mind, I would like for you to tell that story. Because if what I believe is the case is true, it's fucking hilarious and ballsy.
Yeah, no, it's a wild story. I'll try and keep it to the relatively short version. It's one of those stories where when I tell it, I'm like, oh, I'm going to make the short version. But then like every part is like, oh, but that part's so great and I can't skip it.
I got time, man.
I'm going to do my best. So basically around 2006, 2007, Killer Mike was my favorite rapper. You know, I was playing his music here in St. Louis. They were Billboard hits, you know, even though he was, you know, kind of at the lowest underground point of his career after he'd fallen out with Outkast. And he's just trying to like build himself back up. So he's kind of, you know, if they weren't Billboard hits, but I was playing them, you know, at peak hours, like they were like the hottest thing on the charts. Just cause I thought it was great. And, you know, again, I wanted to share it with people. And so he did an interview, in a magazine or a website where he said, you know, I don't have fans, I have supporters. They can contact me on MySpace or call me at and a phone number. And me assuming that the phone number was just going to be like an answering service, basically, you know, just leave your name and number to get joining the fan list or whatever. But, you know, I'm a fan. I'm never afraid to be a fan of someone who, you know, who I think is incredible, even now, let alone back then. So I called the number just wanting to know, you know, what it was like and probably to join the list or what have you. And he answered the phone. Which is amazing and speaks to who he was and who he still is, which, you know, he he's the way he portrays himself as a man of the people like that, he's like that all the time.
Nice. That's always refreshing to hear, like me being a big fan of all three of you guys. Yeah. I mean, I was under the impression that he was very genuine, but to hear it coming from you, that's a positive thing in my day. I'll say that.
No, for sure. And he, he really did put his phone number in there and he really did answer the call. And, you know, I had to think quick and I just, you know, told him what I just said about how I was playing his records at the clubs and putting his songs on mixtapes. And, you know, I was just like, you know, you're amazing. And I was like, more people should know about you. And just thinking quickly, I thought, you know, mixtapes have always been a big thing for me. I put out a couple hundred mixtapes.
Wow.
And, you know, just trying to come up with a reason to have called this man out of the blue. I was just like, you know, I want to do a Best of Killer Mike mixtape and have you host it. And he said, okay.
Wow.
Just, you know, sight unseen. And, you know, so it took a little while going back and forth, email and getting it together, but we got it together and we finally, I put it out in 2009, 8 or 9. I always get that confused. Either way, around then. And then so I went to A3C, which is a hip hop festival in Atlanta, a couple months later. And, you know, I hit him up because I wanted to meet him. I just thought I'd met him in person. I wanted to give him a copy of the CD, just get a photograph. That was enough for me, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Just meeting my favorite rapper and handing him this CD that we made together. And so he was doing an in-store signing at Criminal Records. I went down there. We take a picture and all that. It was great. And I was like, I'm in town all weekend. If you need anything, you know, I got you, whatever. And I'm thinking, you know, go pick up the sandwich from the Subway for him and, you know, throw the tobacco from the inside of the blunt out. You know, so he doesn't have to get up, you know.
Yeah.
Turn my mind. And he says, I'm opening up for Rakim tomorrow. Do you want to DJ for me?
Holy shit.
And it was just, you know, so far from anything I could have expected. I was just like, whoa. I mean, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Which was wild. And so we did that. And then a similar thing happened at South By the following spring, where I just bumped into him and, again, just offered, you know, whatever he needed, I was there for. And he asked if I could do 4 shows with him the following day.
Wow.
And so we did 4 shows that day. And at the end of the last one, he says, you know, this is my new tour DJ, which he hadn't told me beforehand. me and the crowd found out at the same time. So we did a couple years like that. And then, it was just a couple years before he dropped Rap Music with LP, producing it. So then we went on tour with LP, which was amazing because I've been listening to L since high school. And in these years, me and Mike toured opening up for GZA, Big Boy. Like, it was just this crazy experience for me, just as a kid from Wisconsin who, you know, just a few years before was like not even a DJ and just buying these people's CDs every chance I got. So we did the tour with LP and then they decided to make a group. And at the time, L was touring with a band, so he didn't have a DJ, that's what I envisioned was, well, L's had some of the greatest DJs in history tour with him. You know, he's at A-Track and Abilities and Dibs and Len, not A-Track, I don't know why I said that. Len and, you know, so he's got all these amazing dudes that I looked up to before I was even a DJ, but just at the time he wasn't using anybody, so I just automatically slid in there, you know, and no one expected us to be still doing, I mean, I don't think anyone had any expectations either way, but you know, it was just like a thing to try and it just went really, really well for all of us.
I'd certainly say so.
So we've continued doing the Run the Jewels thing.
Nice. So it's been what, about 10 years?
The first album was 2013.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah. So a little over 7. And, although this year doesn't really count.
No, it does. I mean, you guys, I'm a rabid fan, so obviously I'm biased, but you guys got snubbed for Grammys, which I guess isn't that big a surprise, just kind of given the history there. The Grammys in general kind of being tone deaf, I think is a really nice way, the nicest way I can put it. But What's the dynamic, like collaborative dynamic, like between the three of you? You know, you guys put out my favorite album of the year back in the summer. How does that all come together?
So I mean, it always starts with Al making beats. So he'll usually go in his cave and just, make beats, or just over the course of a year or whatever, just whenever he's catches the spirit, he makes beats until he's got, sends them to Mike to see what they're feeling. And then once they've kind of got a good batch of them, they'll get together in the studio for a week or two. This last album was recorded in a variety of places, like some of it at Rick Rubin's studio in Malibu, some at Electric Ladyland in New York. Feel like there was a third studio. And I think they did some of it. Al's got a place in upstate New York. It's amazing. House in the woods with an awesome studio in it. Yeah, so they'll get together and, just write together and get the rap part together, and then, kind of sit on those songs, listen to those, see how they feel. Most of the albums have been done in, a couple batches basically. And I try and be there for the recording process as much as I can, just for my own benefit, because it's amazing to watch. And provide input wherever I can. And then I add scratches to whatever song, whatever songs Ellen envisions scratches on. I do the scratches, and it's an amazing process to watch. I mean, they're both incredible artists. They both work very differently, but they're both, amazing, and watching the way they work together is just unreal. And that's why this has all been what it is. It's all based on their relationship, artistically and just friendship as men. But yeah, it's their dynamic together is and has always been incredible.
Yeah, I mean it certainly comes through in the music. I watched the NPR Tiny Desk concert that you guys did. And you could just tell they're having so much fun. And it's really as a fan, really nice to see. Was that kind of a weird performance for you guys? Maybe not you specifically, I guess maybe more so for them, but it seems a little odd.
No, it was very weird. I mean, for all of us. I mean, first of all, if I remember right, it was like late morning. Like, it was really early in the day. Maybe it was early afternoon. But I remember it feeling early for a performance. And it was a weird space. And, having like 20 people kind of politely clapping versus,
Offbeat too.
the roaring crowd of thousands.
Yeah.
But it was still just a really cool experience. But it was definitely a weird show, but that's the thing, because of the two of them and who they are and their dynamic together, like anything funky like that, like I always look forward to it, because I'm interested to see what they're gonna do and how they're gonna handle it, and
Yeah.
because I mean, the shows are so fun for me too, because something different happens every show, something funny, or like there's little inside jokes that we might have. And it's just there's just so much going on. I definitely really miss doing shows with those guys. It's a good time.
Yeah, I was kind of lamenting earlier about just not doing stand up at all. I mean, the climate where you are is fairly similar. It's not like I'm in California or Texas where I can do outdoor shows all year. Like it's been raining here for yeah, it's still raining for 24 hours straight. So I haven't done a show in a club since February, I want to say. And like Zoom shows, especially for comedy, are they're bearable, but it's not the same as, hanging out with comics that you're best friends with and then kind of going up and kind of the same thing, like kind of inside jokes throughout the show as we each go up and stuff like
For
that.
sure.
So certainly missing that a lot. You mentioned Rick Rubin, obviously legendary producer. I imagine, meeting someone like him would be perhaps a little intimidating. Who were some of the people throughout, your journey and career that you've met where you're just kind of, dumbstruck kind of meeting?
I mean, I'm always a little bit starstruck, And it's funny because, like, I can't tell how starstruck I should or shouldn't be, you know?
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, I'm like, dude, you're just fucking Gabe from Wisconsin. You know, you should be on your knees, you know, we're not
Yeah.
worthy style shit. And
Yeah.
then it's like, okay, but you're also the DJ for Run the Jewels. Have some fucking professionalism, you know?
Yeah.
have some dignity, sir. So that's always a balance to this day. And I've been very, very lucky. I met, you know, most of my heroes at this point. The one time I can remember really just being completely just stupid was the first time I met DJ Shadow, which is funny because now through being, you know, part of Run the Jewels, I'm now friends with Shadow and like we talk and stuff. But the first time I met him, I went to a show of his in St. Louis in like 2006, I want to say. And he's like my favorite DJ, you know, he's like one of my favorite artists ever. Introducing is still like my favorite album, you know, one of, if not the. And I got pretty drunk, apparently, I guess. And when I got to the front to have him sign, you know, like I got in line after the show to have him sign my CD and shirt and stuff. And so I'd been on a DJ Shadow email, fan email list in the 90s, in like the late 90s, which had some, you know, I learned a lot from that list. And also on that list was Diplo, which is always a
Okay.
funny tidbit, looking back and being like, oh yeah, 1998, me and Diplo were on the same DJ Shadow fan email list.
Yeah.
But so I get to the front of the line with Shadow and I'm just like, oh, hi, I'm on Influx, the email list, you know about it, I think. And you know, and I was just like, it was just one of those times where afterwards I was just like, that's not how you talk to people, man. What the fuck did you just do? He didn't remember, unfortunately. I actually just came across the shirt that he'd signed, and I sent him a picture of it. You know, I found it in my basement. And I was like, dude, this is from 2006. He was like, oh shit, I remember that show, but he didn't remember me, fortunately.
I had a similar
I'm sure
thing.
I'm one of many people who've
Yeah.
useless talking to him in that situation.
Yeah, you have to go like way further down the crazy spectrum to be remembered like more than a decade later. I did a show in Toronto, man, probably close to 10 years ago, 9 or 10 years ago, with some other local comics and Seth Meyers from, SNL and all that stuff. And same thing. Like when I wasn't married, I was a single guy living in a very small apartment, just doing stand up every single night, no responsibilities. So have a beer during my set and then just throw them back afterwards because you don't really have anything else going on. And I think I asked him 3 or 4 times to take a picture. And the first 2 times he obliged. And then the third time he was like, "We already took a picture." And I was like, "Oh, I forgot. I am so sorry." But I had another moment like that where a couple summers ago, you mentioned you'd been to Toronto, but obviously you guys are going there to perform, which I can relate to. It's not like you're jumping on a double-decker bus and checking out everything. There's a club though, a comedy bar, been around for I think 10 years. I've been producing shows there for like 9. So I was doing a show. And I'm just sitting in the green room before the show starts, and the door to the green room opens. So I'm like, oh, it's either going to be another comic or it's going to be, a staff member. But it wasn't. It was Anna Gasteyer from Saturday Night Live. So she comes in the door and she's like, oh, I thought this was the washroom. And I was like, hi. Because I watched her growing up on SNL. Also, she's in like Mean Girls, all that stuff. I was like, holy shit. So my wife is at home, pregnant with our son. I go outside and I call her and I'm like, guess who just rolled into the green room? It's crazy. And she was like, wow, it's nuts. I was like, all right, I gotta go. I'm gonna do the show. I'm gonna head in. She's like, okay, have fun. And I hang up my phone, put it in my pocket, and look up, and Oscar from The Office is walking down the stairs towards
Oh
me. And I
shit.
was like, come on. And there were a couple of other people. They were all filming a TV show and they decided to come by the club. And I was like, wow, I didn't embarrass myself with them though. Thank goodness. And so you guys tour, I mean, not right now, but like crazy. Like I checked out the website recently, and you're actually going to be like 20 minutes from where I live. So I'm going to check that out if and when it happens next summer. What are some of the kind of craziest most wild road stories that you'd be willing to tell, whether or not it involves you?
Man, this is like a pretty standard question. And I was kind of, we're lucky because we Run the Jewels blew up like this, when, I was 34 and Mike and Elle were 39. And they both had their fame and their, run. But, at this point, we're all pretty, settled people. We're all married. We all still do a bit of drinking and drugs, but not a ton. We don't, there's not that many like wild, salacious stories. I'm sure there's some funny shit. I can just never think of like one standout thing. When it comes to, when I think of the wild stuff, I'm thinking about, trashed hotel rooms and, groupies. There's, we've not really been privy to much of that in this run. But something funny. I mean, yeah, I don't know, because everything I think of doesn't sound good next to a trashed hotel room tale, but it's just all the little stuff on stage. My turntables fell. We were in Austin, and the guys just kind of like laughed at me. My whole setup just ended up on the floor. The table gave out, and,
Oh, Jesus.
cut the whole show off. There's something I posted on my Instagram a couple times where the power went out when we were in Barcelona. And I jokingly suggested Mike and I'll do a dance off because they couldn't speak to the crowd. And I was like, do a dance off. And I was just trying to make them laugh. And then they did like a dance off in front of, 10,000 people or whatever it was. Just a completely silent dance off on stage. That was Primavera Festival. But yeah, no, I'm always kind of disappointing when I answer that question because I just can't think anything too exciting off the top.
To be fair though, you did give it good context with, your age, the fact that you're married and you have a kid. Yeah, you don't exactly want to be, shooting heroin in a McDonald's or anything like that. That's what Burger King's for.
And we're lucky because they've made all the mistakes and I've made some of the mistakes already before we got here. So I think that's really facilitated our not fucking this up and Run the Jewels continuing to do everything it's done and take advantage of this amazing support we've got from all these fans.
Cool. And so in my sleuthing, my investigative journalistic endeavors, I found out you've been together with your wife for quite some time. How did the two of you meet?
So yeah, we've been together 14. Yeah, coming up on 15 years. We met on MySpace, just like everyone else.
Classic love story.
Yeah, so we she had just moved to St. Louis. I'd been here 6 years at that point, five and a half years. But she just moved here, and I saw her comment on someone's page, and it was weird because it wasn't like, ooh, that picture's hot. Let me click on it and look at it. It was like, oh, something's going on. And it was just weird because I'm not a mystical dude. I'm not religious. I'm none of that type of shit. But it was just weird because I was just like, I clicked on it, I looked at her shit, and I was just like, why do I feel like I'm definitely gonna like be with her? It was just weird. And I would have thought that was some dumb weird bullshit, but turned out I was right. So I don't know. So yeah, I pursued her, and we got it together after a little while, and yeah, we've been together since. We've moved together like 8 times. we've lived in 4 different cities together. It's been a fun adventure. Once I started touring, obviously it sucked being away from her a lot of the time, but it was also great because then, I'd fly her out to places when we had, a couple days in the city. So she's gotten to, it's funny, we talk about how it seems like she doesn't get to travel much because the person she lives with travels an insane amount. But then when you look at it, you're like, oh wait, most people take like one vacation a year.
Yeah.
And you know, she's, you know, if, you know, we've been to Europe a few times where we've had like a couple weeks off in between shows or something. So instead of fly home, I'll just fly her out there. And yeah, we've had a great decade and a half together. You know, the last couple of years have gotten even more interesting because we've got a 2-year-old daughter, Amina. So that's been the latest phase of the adventure. And yeah, we're very lucky. I'm very lucky.
Nice. That's awesome. It's funny though. You mentioned you guys met online, you know, back in 2006, that's kind of like a weird thing where people are like, ugh, like that person must be desperate or up to no good. But now it's almost weird if that's not how you met because
yeah, I'm sure.
You have, you know, apps and shit like that. But I had a similar, I mean, to a degree, you know, I am not like a spiritual person. I'm not at all religious. Like I was baptized Catholic and it's in remission essentially is how I would describe how religious I am. But I had a thing, my wife and I, we met in college like 13, 14 years ago. And I could just tell we hadn't even spoken. And I was like, that one right there. Yes, please.
Yep.
And then yep. She ended up coming to one of my shows. She followed me on Twitter, came to one of my shows in 2012. And then that's been it. Inseparable. So I had a sixth sense with that one. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the whole, that was going to be one of my questions. You know, the fact that you're able to, you have the means to, you know, have her come out when, you know, you're overseas or out of state is certainly a positive. And so what kind of things, you mentioned your daughter is 2, what kind of things going into parenthood have you experienced that you did not see coming? And how have you kind of adjusted to those types of challenges?
You mean during parenthood?
Yeah, and like kind of the
what kinds?
And during kind of the transition to, you know, one day, you know, it's just the two of you, and then boom, you got a third wheel.
Yeah. Man. Well, I mean, we had a very long and complicated path towards having Amina. She was born very early, and my wife was on bed rest for 7 weeks before she was born. So we had a lot of downtime. She was on bed rest in the hospital for 7 weeks.
Holy.
So we had a lot of downtime to contemplate our changing life. You know, I don't know. I mean, she and I have always communicated well. We've been talking about having kids for a long time. So, you know, obviously it's a shock and there's nothing that can prepare you for being responsible for someone 24 hours a day and, you know, introducing that dynamic to your household in every way, shape and form, you know, in terms of taking up space and taking up finances and
yeah.
taking up time. And, but you know, I don't think it's been as crazy as it could be just cause you know, she and I work together well, you know, we've been best friends for a long time and, you know, certainly there's been challenges and the sleep thing is always tough, but it works out pretty well because she's good in the morning and I have always been good staying up late. So, you know, like I said, Amina was born really early. So she spent 9 weeks in the NICU. And then wow. When she finally came home, obviously we were, you know, nervous. So we did 24-hour coverage on her for, you know, I don't even remember how long, a month or two or three. So Camille would watch her all day and I would stay up all night, you know, and then sleep from 7 a.m. to, you know, mid-afternoon or whatever.
Jeez.
So we've just always been able to work, you know, work stuff out however we need to. But it's, I mean, it's definitely challenging and life-changing. I guess we just expected it to be. So, you know, with how difficult it was getting through the year of the pregnancy, you know, we're just really thankful to have her and have her be perfectly healthy, which is amazing. So, you know, we just count our blessings on that.
Yeah. I mean, your point about, you know, sleeping in shifts kind of thing, that was one of the major challenges that we faced. And I was all gung ho, before our son was born, to have a second one. But then the first 3 months that he was alive, it was like water torture, like the lack of sleep. And I'm obviously biased. We hit the jackpot. The good-looking kid, he's smart and he's funny and he's healthy. We've essentially decided he's one and done. How do you kind of handle, work and family life balance? I mean, now I imagine it's not all that difficult. But prior to the pandemic, how were you able to balance the two?
And I guess that's another way I should say that we're really lucky, and it's been easier to face a lot of the challenges is, I've got my job, which is obviously amazing, that, I tour. But then when I'm not touring, I'm at home. And my wife has an online jewelry business, which, she hasn't had a job in 11 or 12 years. She's been very successful with that. So between the two of us, we've got a lot of flexibility, which is what enabled the sleep thing. I mean, if either of us had to go to a job at a certain time, that would have, I don't even know what that would have been like. But I definitely understand everyone who is in that position and the sleep challenges presented. But yeah, we're just both very lucky to have the jobs we have. And so we were able to work all that out. And yeah, this year, I mean, the one silver lining of this year is I've been with Amina, from March till now, instead of being gone for, the majority of that time. It's been really cool to get to watch her every day. And, as much as I was looking forward to getting back to touring, because we've been mostly off the road all of last year as well, and most of 2018, just a few dates here and there. So I was really excited to get back to touring, but it's also drives me crazy to think about leaving Amina and not seeing her for 2 weeks, and then I come back and she's, at this point she's a different person every day. So, 2 weeks later and just seeing her on FaceTime or Zoom or whatever, my cat wants trouble.
Oh, there we go. What's that guy's name?
Wolfie.
Well, oh man, we had a dog. We had a dog, a Schipperke. I don't know if you know the breed, but he died back in March. But my nickname for him was Wolfie
Sorry to hear that.
because of Terminator 2. When John
That's
Connor,
why Wolf that
come
that's
on,
why Wolfie's named Wolfie.
come on. That's something special right there. Okay.
It's a girl cat with a boy dog name.
Beautiful. I'm
No, yeah,
glad that that's the source of the name.
she showed up in our backyard August 2017, and so we kind of took her in, and while we were kind of contemplating keeping her, was when they did a re-release of T2 in the theaters. So we went and saw it. I think it was in 3D. Yeah, it was in the 3D re-release or whatever. So we went and saw it, and on the way back, we were thinking about calling her Jazzy Bell. But on the way back, I was just like, if we keep that cat, I want to name her Wolfie. And Camille was just like, okay. I was like, all right, cool.
Yeah, that
But
is
yeah,
very
she's been Wolfie
coincidental.
ever since.
Nice. We have two cats. One is Muggins, and he's pretty cool. We recently got, I thought it would be a really nice idea, because my son's very adventurous. I didn't have pets growing up.
Yeah, neither.
So I was like, we should get the boy a kitten for Christmas, as one of his gifts. My wife was like, well, we've had this cat for like a month now. She was like, well, we don't want to wait that long. All the good ones will be gone. And she's like the cat whisperer. She picked she, since she was a kid, she's picked out her family cats, batting 1,000. No duds anywhere. But she got, my son calls everyone or everything Joey. Like if he has three toy dinosaurs, I'm like, hey, what are their names? He's like, three Joeys. And I'm like, fuck,
That's
okay.
amazing.
We know what this cat's name is gonna be. The kitten comes home, and my wife is like, hey Ben, you get to name the cat. This is your cat. What are you gonna name it? And he was like, Peaches. So now we have, he could have been a Joey. Fucking Peaches.
Missed a shot.
Yeah, that's it. Never gonna overcome. But you are white. Your wife is black. You live in
Yes.
America. There are obviously kind of racial tensions. And you know, same thing here in Canada with the way our Indigenous people have been treated and continue to be treated, as well as other races, essentially. Is that something that kind of weighs on your mind? Just so far as I don't even know exactly how to ask this question properly, but you know, your daughter is black. Are you at all
Yes.
concerned as to, you know, what some experiences may be for her simply because of the color of her skin?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, I've since I took an interest in hip hop, I you know, quickly realized that, you know, to really fully love and understand the culture, it's essential that you love and understand black people and their experience in America. So, you know, that was something that I, you know, worked to try and understand. And, you know, I still have a fraction of the understanding of, you know, actual black people. But it's something that, you know, I've wanted to understand that perspective better, for a long time. And, you know, my wife recognized that in me. I mean, she's a very proud black person. She's, you know, she didn't expect to end up with a white man, in her life. It just kind of happened to her.
To her.
If I didn't have a certain amount of compassion and you know, interest in understanding all those dynamics and all that history, you know, it wouldn't have worked with her. But we definitely, I mean, we talk all the time about, I mean, the situation for her. And you know, I mean, at this point in my life, most of my friends are black, and you know, I worry for what America has done and continues to do to them and their families and the people they care about. And certainly it's a huge concern for Amina's future, and that plays into where we talk about and think about settling down long term. You know, I mean, we've continued to move around. We've been in Atlanta, which was beautiful because it's an amazing, the blackness of that city is unlike anywhere else that, you know, that in America. And we love it for that reason. And, you know, California is, you know, probably the most liberal of the 48 states, which is not to say it still doesn't have massive race issues, but, you know, it's a little bit lighter there. You know, and just in terms of the atmosphere and what you feel like you have to think about on a moment to moment basis. And we love St. Louis, and St. Louis certainly has its issues, obviously. Compared to the rest of Missouri, it's pretty good. But
Yeah.
you know, yeah, I mean, it definitely weighs heavily, and Amina will certainly understand as soon as she's able to understand that she's black. And you know, yeah, I mean, it's that's a point of conversation every day with me and Camille. That's not a subject that we, you know, hide from or don't take seriously, or you know, we know how essential that is.
No, definitely. I mean, I spoke with a guy. His name is Len Elmore. I don't know if you're familiar with him at all. Okay, yeah. So I had him on. Incredibly impressive life. And I mean, one thing that he said to me that really stuck out was, you know, our kids, I believe he has two sons, if memory serves correctly. And he said, we have the talk with them. And for someone like me, I'm a white guy. I grew up. The town that I currently live in is the town I grew up in. When I was a kid, I want to ballpark it at around 95% of the population here was white. It's certainly more diverse now, but at the time that was how it was. So for me, the talk is, you know, the birds and the bees kind of thing. That's not how it is for black people, and so it's just to hear it from somebody like him who has lived that life. Accomplished all the things he has. He, you know, Harvard Law School, played in the NBA for 10 years, more stuff I'm forgetting. And to see that he's still treated, no one should be treated that way, obviously. That's not what I'm saying, but it's especially horrifying when you see somebody like all these things you did and the person that you are doesn't matter to some people. And that's really fucking depressing. And that's not the note that I want to end on. And so my final question for you is one that I ask often. If you could go back right before you became a parent, is there any advice that you would give to your past self? And if so, what do you imagine that might sound like?
That's an interesting question. It's still so fresh. We're only 2 years in. Given the unique circumstances, I think my advice might be, stock up on toilet paper and Clorox wipes and ammo. I guess if that included knowing about the pandemic, then there'd be a bunch of stuff
For
that I
sure.
would plan for. Move into a place with a swimming pool, since you're not gonna be allowed to go outside. I don't. There's got to be something, but I can't really think of anything. It's been really hard and the craziest thing ever. But I don't feel like there's been a lot that's been unexpected. Just because my wife and I talked about it so much and thought about it so much, and we had her when we were 37. So it's not like we were 22 and like, oh my God, what the fuck is happening? We'd had 15, 20 years of our friends having kids to learn from, and siblings have kids. Again, I don't think I have a. I don't think I have a great answer for that unless it's related pandemic stockpiling. We've been lucky that Amin has been a great kid, and we've had a relatively tolerable first 2 years of parenthood.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned to me that your daughter is currently napping, and that brought out a great deal of resentment because my kid no longer
Yes.
naps. So
Yes.
I hope for you that continues for a couple of years until it's time that it, and you don't want her to be like 15 and napping,
Yeah,
but
I'm hoping for eight or nine,
oh man, I wish I might
keep it
start
going.
safely dosing my son with melatonin.
Yeah.
And so appreciate you doing the show. I want to talk
Absolutely.
about your website very quickly. I recently got some stuff. I got a hat, a hoodie, and a
Yes,
t-shirt.
thank you for that, by the way. I meant to thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, it looks the
I meant to
stuff
do that at
looks
the beginning. I
great.
just forgot.
No problem. I'm looking forward to getting it. The stuff looks great. Tell people where they can find you, what your website is, social media, all that good stuff.
Yeah, so the hub for it is kind of just rapfan.com, rapfan.com. The main thing is it's the merch, my Rap Fan merch line, which includes collaborations with Run the Jewels. But then from there you can get to my Trackstar website and I'm on Shade 45 on Sirius Radio every Friday night. So there's a link there to check out playlists and everything. And yeah, all the socials are on there too, but it's DJ Trackstar on Twitter, Trackstar the DJ on Instagram. I definitely appreciate you supporting the site. I appreciate everyone who's, bought stuff, especially this year. The merch line is crucial. When I started, it was because at that point, we were just kind of starting out, and I wasn't making very much on stage to where, it was barely covering my costs of eating and living. So I wanted to supplement it with something, so I came up with the merch line, and 8 years later, I'm really grateful for all the support from you and all the other jewel runners or non-jewel runners, although I suspect it's mostly jewel runners.
Yeah, I mean, it's the support has certainly been earned. We do need the MySpace link though, because that's where
Yes,
love happens.
it was DJ Trackstar. I don't know if it's still there or not, but it's worth if you want to marry me, that's the way to get to.
All right, get on it, ladies. Cool. Thank you so much for doing the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks, man. Good talking to you.